Hey, welcome back to Rhetoric Warriors, the podcast, where we are teaching people the power of ethical-only persuasion. We've got to get rid of all this unethical persuasion. It is complicated things. This is January 21st when we're recording this, so we are now the relieved states of America. And we will talk about that some today. I am Dr. Dan French, American rhetorician, escaped professor, also stand-up comedian, late-night writer from Hollywood. I write jokes all the time on social media. You can go to Twitter and find us at Rhetoric War for jokes. Here's a few from the week. Like I said, yesterday was the inauguration, so I have lots of inauguration jokes. There was a no-fly zone over Washington during the ceremony, which made Mike Pence happy. Wait a second. Get the image. Fly on white hair. Garth Brooks performed, looked very out of place. So much for friends in low places. He's apparently wanting to move up in the world. God, that was uncomfortable watching him. Afterwards, he sang, and then afterwards, he took off his he didn't put his mask back on. He kissed like eight different politicians. I think he was trying to take out the top of the blue realm. I saw a woman today on social media saying that Biden is the Antichrist. And I think if you think Biden's the Antichrist, you need to revisit your research a little bit. I don't think the Antichrist hugged his grandkids that much. So the podcast today, I convert conservatives on the podcast, which is super fun for me. I talk to comedians about their politics, and we gather great stuff from persuasion pros. Go to rhetoricwarriors.com. Take a course. Just launched Converting Conservatives. Change the world by altering one wayward mind at a time. I'm going to teach all the blues how to turn people from reds to blues before the 2022 midterms. That's my thing. My guest today, I don't know. This guy I've known for a long time. I always describe you, Steve, as like one of the super nicest people I know. Funny guy, comedian, politically astute, had a radio show for a while. He's an editor, an actor. Everybody welcome Steve Gelder.
Thanks, Dan French. Dr. Dan French.
Dr. Dan. I prefer like Jill Biden.
Yeah, Jill. You've delivered a baby then at some point, I assume. Isn't
well,
that it wasn't
I was
that
at the front
established?
End. I was at the front end of that delivery process.
That was part of the process. I initiated most of this. Yeah, isn't it according to the right now that unless you've actually delivered a baby, you don't deserve the title of doctor?
Yeah, you know, I think you got to give it to the right. You know, they are the unethical persuader camp that I talk about. And I don't really care if they're conservatives or not. I care about unethical persuasion. But they are so good at nitpicking a slander. Man, they can find the tiniest little thing and just turn it into a major brush fire.
Well, and it's not even it's a title that she earned. There's not a way you should even be able to slander it. Yet they've managed to find a way to somehow tear it down a little bit and pretend like,
it's great. They're great at it.
We should pay attention to Dr. Rand Paul, the ophthalmologist. He knows a lot about medicine and science, but Dr. Jill Biden, screw that.
No. You couldn't do. Yeah. No. You gotta be, ophthalmologist. Now, that guy, I listened to Rand Paul with that curly hair, and I'm like, come on, I'm from Kentucky. We gave everybody McConnell and Rand Paul. Oof. And I'm sorry, but I'm sorry.
You owe us. You owe us big time.
I moved out when I was 17 and never went back because of that. Because of Kentucky.
Every time Rand Paul speaks, I gain more respect for his neighbor, the guy who punched him. I'm just like, I understand this man so deeply.
We never got the story on that, did we?
Do you need much more than he lives next door to him? It's like at some point you just like, whatever it was over, like, hey, you know, your branch is across here and technically these apples belong to me. Boosh. Right.
Yeah, but he was in Rand Paul's neighborhood, so he's probably the same thing. He was probably just as Rand as Paul is.
Right.
So run us your background a little bit, Steve. I knew you from North Carolina and Raleigh when you were a stand-up comic, and then we knew each other some out in L.A.
Yeah.
Moved out there.
Yeah, originally from North Dakota. Lived out there for a few years, got into, wanted
really?
To
That's
become
a nice
comedian.
Liberal state.
Oh my God. I have so many discussions slash arguments with friends of mine from my hometown on Facebook regularly because they are so deeply into the Republican side of things. This is where I've always been opposed to the two-party system because I knew eventually it would turn into this thing where it's just like you support your team no matter what. And you can put the most horrible human being at the head of your team and you will say he is great because you have to love Bill Belichick, you know, or whatever. It's just, and so we've ended up with this thing where it's like just red against blue. We've broken it down to that much. We don't even want to use the whole Republican Democrat. Those are too many syllables, red, blue. And we just fight and fight over, you know, color domination or something like that. Right. North Dakota originally.
Politics has become a video game, you know, where it's just good and evil. And those are our categories, and you know we have colors for them, and just get and there's a one shooter and just take out all the wrong color and go.
And now we've got RPG players who are actually dressing up in like buffalo hats with horns and red and blue painted faces and carrying spears, and it's just another extension of what we've been doing for decades.
Yeah, I talk about it in the course. You know, with the nice thing about rhetoric is that. Gives you a way to elevate these simple discussions into something that's complicated. And that one sort of stories are much easier for people to understand than sort of complicated logic and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So that runs a lot of people's minds these days, story software. And right. It really is. It's like, you know, Trump is an anti-hero. He fits, you know, they just drag him into the American tradition of the anti-hero. George Washington was an anti-hero, for God's sakes. You know, fighting with a ragtag bunch of guerrilla militia and, you know, sneak attacking the British. So there's a long tradition of it. And Trump just slipped, as I describe it, he's the clown who slipped behind the wheel of the Porsche, you know. And so the whole system was here. It's not like he had to do much other than just talk like an asshole. And they just give him all of that, you know, story.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And this... The story that I was told when I was younger is that there would be checks and balances in place to prevent this kind of thing. And unfortunately, our system of checks and balances is predicated on the idea that people will behave honorably.
Yeah.
And we've got so much less of that, evidenced by, you know, the ex-president flying out before the inauguration, refusing to take part in any of the ceremony, any of the pomp and circumstance, any of the stuff he normally loves when it's all about him. But now, since it would be pointing out the fact that he had lost something, there'll be no, you know, there'll be no getting along. There'll be no doing the right thing. None of that stuff.
Yeah. It turns out when you drop a narcissist into a loose system, they take advantage of it. I've noticed.
Yes. Yes. He seems to have really done that. It's amazing. I've read like a lot of the different retrospective pieces on Trump leaving and the different things that he did along the way. That you forget about because there's been such a high number of unusual, you know, moves that he's made, actions he's taken. So there's like threads on Twitter of like 60, 70 some different things that he's done where you just go, oh yeah, remember when he stared at the sun during the eclipse? Oh yeah, remember the time he did the thing and this thing and that thing? And they just pile up and up and up. And he's been allowed to do it and get away with it. And it's been a 4-year period of that, which has just rocked the country in like the weirdest way. And now that he's gone, Republicans who have encouraged that behavior and his actions this whole time are suddenly aware that we have a deficit and a debt. And you know, there's a thing called COVID that has killed people. And, you know,
well, Biden brought that along. Biden, you know, escaped the Biden's lab. That's how the COVID came, is Biden was, you know, in China, experimenting on monkeys, in China. You know, like the Antichrist will, and he loosed the virus upon us.
God, it is.
Yeah,
just...
it's an interesting time. You know, I mean, it's nice now because, you know, the Blues just won something. So it feels like there's some respite, you know, that you're protected a little bit again. You don't have to fear your president. Like no matter what Biden
as
does,
much.
You know, he's never gonna, like, there was a, I don't know if you saw the video today of a MAGA woman just weeping about Biden and, you know, he's come to destroy us and, you know, just that you could tell like the full authentic pain of this.
Right.
That
they believe just, this.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me.
The you mentioned before about like dropping a narcissist into the system, and having Trump being in charge and then watching a major narcissist who's got almost unlimited power, you know, relatively speaking to what everybody else in the United States has, to watch him lose badly and not deal with it well is a nice way to phrase that. Just watching it has been fascinating, because he is having like some major breakdowns and major psychological things going on. And it's not something that a lot of people in the world ever have to deal with. Like, yeah, I would imagine.
Have you ever run into a narcissist? Like, I've dated, you know, since I got divorced, I've been divorced for 15 years. So I've dated around, and I clipped into one narcissist, and it's super odd. But like, I've talked to a lot of different people who like will get divorced from a narcissist, and what a horrible experience it is, because they won't let go. And they love courts. They love dragging people into court, because the court starts with this idea that everybody's normal and they can hide behind that.
Right. Right. You know? You're treated like you're bringing a case. And so you've got the respect of like being a defendant or,
and you can on the say side of the prosecution, craziest, or wildest stuff. And they have to act like it's true for at least for a while. And so they love it.
Right.
You saw it with Trump.
No,
all of his lawsuits are the same thing.
I've probably run into narcissists in my life. I've talked to Bud Friedman, you know, but it's not like I've spent a lot of time interacting with them, because normally I'll withdraw myself from that kind of person.
Yeah. A relationship is horrific. Like in that.
Oh man.
Horrific.
Yeah. I can't imagine. I mean, you're probably drawn at first to like, this person has some self-confidence and they seem attractive because they're very sure of themselves and they know what they're saying, and you get involved. And of course, you know, at some point, probably the sex is great. And then you're just like, you're stuck in that thing, and you start to realize, oh no, this person thinks they should be like the leader of everything, and that they're whatever their issue, their thought process is.
That's a tricky psychology. Like you said, most people don't encounter it very much. And
yeah,
a lot of narcissists are really smart. They're really, they have a lot of personality. They're interesting people, and they don't show you everything up front, you know? So it's not like you can suddenly go, oh, what? No way. So I think you're right. It's a really interesting time for the country to see what happens when you really open up our system to dysfunction, like a dysfunctional character, what they will do.
Well, and the kind of dysfunction that it prompts in the part of the country that follows that team, you know, that red or blue team. It's like people have lost their minds. People have lost family members. People have lost relationships. People have said goodbye to a lot of common sense stuff. There's the current thing that's going around with QAnon is that, the United States has not been a country since like 1870 something, when Ulysses S. Grant, I think, was the last legitimate president of the United States. And we've been owned by the city of London since then.
Nice.
And their evidence of these things is that you ever see flags that have like gold fringe on them?
Uh-huh.
That's the corporate flag of London. It's not the Admiralty flag of the United States that we've commonly used in courthouses and all this other stuff for centuries. It's this thing that you've never heard about in school or anywhere before. It's just suddenly dropped, fully formed into the middle of the QAnon folks, and they pick it up and run with it as if it is fact.
Well, again, go back to the storyism, like the Da Vinci Code is the exact same thing. Like the story format of these deeply hidden mysteries, you know, in the world,
mm-hmm.
The whole thing, religion is a deeply hidden mystery, you know, so that storytelling format of there's stuff in here we just haven't found, like CSI is the same thing, you know, it's going in and finding these deeply hidden mysteries from these clues that nobody else even sees. So there's a right. lot of training for Americans to accept that kind of stuff, you know,
You're basically saying everyone in QAnon, as they were storming the Capitol, in the back of their head was hearing the Law and Order like dun dun
dun dun dun dun. Well, this idea that I'm not going to be taken in because I can see evidence, you know, that I've been pointed to, and other people can't see it, And it's a fascinating psychology that's become, you know, cable media and social media and this explosion of media into our lives has created this type of storyism that you haven't had before. And it's recycling a lot of these old myths like that, like right. the QAnon stuff and the, you know, the stuff that the Nazis said about the Jews. You know, that right. stuff is coming back in because it's now got format. It's got platform for it to be distributed. Whereas before they'd hand out a stupid pamphlet, you know?
Right.
Like, oh, this is stupid. But now, you know.
Yeah. I mean, many things can be made to seem legitimate on the internet because you can make a website that looks like it is delivering the news when it's actually just throwing out propaganda. You can put up a website that looks like it's helping to direct you to better information when it's just directing you back to more propaganda sites. And people, we have a real problem in the country with people not being able to discern good information from bad and being able to research, do their own like actual research beyond just finding a site that agrees with what you already believe. But like going, okay, I need to look at a little bit from the far left. I need to look at a little bit from the middle mainstream. I need to look at the right. I need to figure out where that story came from and how much of it is true. Like if I only get one sentence and they keep showing me just the one sentence on the right, that's probably the most inflammatory sentence that the, you know, will work against the left and vice versa. It works both ways. But it's, you're right, the right, the conservatives, the Republicans at this point have really gotten the, they've had a grip on that sort of thing for ages. They also work very well in lockstep when it comes to like passing a message along.
Yeah, they've actually got an architecture for it. I mean, it's built down from, you know, funded think tanks, hand it down to the media, hand it down to the politicians, and they all right. repeat the same. It's like, you know, one day after or within hours of the Capitol storm, the word unity came down.
Right. Know? Yeah. And we've got to quit talking about blame.
The left.
No, there's
that.
Unfortunately with the left. And this I noticed back in the Occupy movement when I was involved in that in like 2012, whenever that was brewing and happening out here. The left has too many voices all speaking for their same thing. The right is one unified voice speaking for the wrong thing. Generally.
Right.
Whereas the left has a lot of voices that are speaking for things that do matter. But like at the point, the main point of like Occupy Wall Street at the time, the Occupy movement was talk about that.
Tell about your history with that a little bit, because I.
Sure. I got involved. You know, we heard about it happening, Occupy Wall Street out in New York. You know, it was making a little bit of a difference. They did, you know, took over the space, different parks, things like that. We're getting some interest and they started to spring up in different areas. And L.A. naturally went into one of those as well. And the area around City Hall in downtown L.A. was taken over. And I went down there on the first day and was really impressed by what I was seeing. A lot of really intelligent people trying to speak out towards this, like the inequity of, you know, Wall Street always gets bailed out. Businesses always get bailed out. The humans, the people who are the citizens of the country, don't get any assistance. And we're supposed to always make it back up, you know, by pulling ourselves up by the bootstraps, et cetera, et cetera. And so I got involved with it. I decided I'd be a part of it. I took food down there. I would, I collected some money occasionally from people from outside the area who were interested, would buy supplies, and I made sandwiches. I would take bags and bags of food and sandwiches down, just walk around, pass them out, talk to people. Did a few broadcasts from down there, talked to like NPR when I was down there, a few other things. And it was very exciting and very, it felt like it was going to be very transformational. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, at some point, the city hall just shut it down. There was like a nighttime effort. I'd gone down a couple of times. One time specifically, I remember going down and just telling my wife, Gray Drake, that I was, I don't know why I did that. I just tossed both names out. I told her, I think I'm probably going to be arrested tonight. So just be prepared. I'll call you for bail, all that sort of thing. And it got very close to it. We were holding a public function in like a bank's property. And we had all just done like a little sit down thing. And at one point the cops had said, look, you can get up and leave right now, or we're arresting everybody who's still sitting down. And somebody who was more of a leader figure at the thing said, let's save it for a better time. And we all stood up and left. I was set to get arrested. It's like no big deal, as far as I could see.
Yeah, well, you've been arrested hundreds of times, so that was for a good reason. I mean, come on.
You know, yeah, exactly. It is Yeah, the other times, the drugs, the drinking, who cares about those? No, it would have been my first like official arrest and booking, I think. I did get picked up one time because of a misunderstanding with a traffic ticket that had been paid in Florida. They didn't have the record of it in North Carolina, so I got stopped for something else and was handcuffed and fingerprinted and et cetera.
Really? For a traffic ticket?
For a reciprocal agreement between Florida and North Carolina. They thought I hadn't paid the ticket. And so whatever deal they had worked out, I was taken down. Amazing. And I also had to do a set at our local comedy club, Charlie Goodnight's, that night. was released on my own recognizance with enough time, but still went down to the stage with my fingers blue from ink and just walked up, held my hands up and said, "Guess what kind of day I've been having?"
That's classic. Yeah, how often do you get to do that? Need that one on tape. Where's that at?
Yeah, totally forgot about that till just now. Man, it's a good thing I talk to you occasionally. So Wall Street, or Occupy Wall Street, the LA branch, was shut down and different movements happened as a result. I ended up starting a podcast for a while, Independent Thinking, because I've always been a political independent, very opposed to the two-party idea. And I think there's a lot of good political ideas out there. And there are some on both sides. I do think some folks on the conservative side have some good takes on things.
Really?
I do think so.
Give me one.
I can't come up with one right off the top of my head.
That's just this idea of equanimity and being, you know, even-handed and all that stuff. My thing is, like, so here's my political base right now that I use for this stuff that I do. I'm trying to turn okay. everybody to fun America. Like, I just want this to be a fun, enjoyable country, right? Ooh. That's my politics. Right. I vote for the funnest candidate.
Okay. Huh? I will go for that until we get to the point where there's actual clowns with, like, makeup on them. All right, sure.
They're not fun. Clowns aren't fun. But come on, great stand-up. You'd vote for a great stand-up if they were up there, vote, you know, as an option. But
And stand-ups have won in other countries.
Conservatism isn't fun.
Where's no, that's true. Fun?
Nah, none. None of it's fun. It's anti-fun.
All right. Well, in the United States of Fun America, I believe you are correct on your assertion there. Yeah, I don't know. I think that there can be some good ideas on both sides. I was not a fan of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Don't know what that is.
It was one of the deals that was in place that Trump actually got rid of. It was going through, and for me, there was a lot of question about like sort of like copyright property, like what your rights were with regard to that. And a lot of things were being given away in order to get into this trade deal. So a lot of individuals such as yourself and myself might not have the same hold on our intellectual property, images, et cetera. So there were a lot of things in there, as well as a couple of other aspects that I didn't care as much for. Trump torpedoed it almost immediately. I was okay with that. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. It's, you know, okay. It's like, all right, the TPP, I'm okay with that going away. It's left us a little bit vulnerable, probably on the world stage, trade with China. All the places that we stepped out of, that Trump pulled us out of, China has stepped in. Yeah. So it's like all these people are concerned that Biden is China's puppet or something like that. It's like, no. Trump was a puppet, but he benefited China just by taking us out of a ton of things.
Yeah. Well, you're wonky a little bit. You actually think about some of these issues.
Like yeah, it's weird that way.
You go into the internal workings of some of these, you know, bills and, you know, plans and, you know, agreements.
Yeah, that's the sad part of being me. It's like I actually understand enough of politics to be frustrated by it because we could be so much further along if we just, I mean, we could be living almost in the Star Trek sort of era generation that we all fantasized about as kids back in the 70s or whatever. But we don't want to do that because there's an entire political faction that's basically riding everything they've got on the same.
Sure.
Conservatives just want things to be the same. They want to conserve it as it is now. They don't want to conserve resources. They'll drill in Alaska and put oil all over penguins or whatever. They don't care about that. But they don't want their life as they know it to change in any great way. And for a lot of them, that's because they're like middle-aged white guys and their families, and things have always been pretty good for them. But if you're a brown or black or Asian or whatever color person, nationality, whatever, here in the United States, things have not been this glorious, you know, like, oh, look how fantastic the 4th of July is every year or whatever.
Well, that's a good question, though. Like, so one of the basis foundational principles in persuasion is that if you're going to try to persuade somebody, you need to offer them things. There needs to be value and benefit in, you know, what you're saying for them. And this is okay. A problem. Like I said a few times about Hillary Clinton, that I think she might have won if she had used the two words white people ever. You know, she talked a lot about, you know, underserved populations and women and, you know, minority cultures and all that. And that was clearly part of that, you know, it's part of that blue politics, the millennial politics. And that's great, but you're still a big, you know, chunk of voters are white people, and they get concerned when you hear nothing but sort of benefits around them and these sort of abstract benefits of the middle class or the working class or America, when everybody else is talking in terms, very specific terms of skin color and ethnicities and culture groups and demographics.
Right.
And she never even said, look, I understand that if you are a white person in America right now, traditional white person who has traditional, you know, Christian values and things like that, a lot of this stuff looks scary.
Things are changing. Yeah.
But we have to, you know, you can't just put all the political energy towards people who've been underserved. You still have to give political energy to the people who, you know, haven't done anything wrong in particular by going hard at the system that was here. So I think that's been missing, you know, in the Democratic politics.
They still need to know what the benefit is going to be for them.
Yeah.
If they're voting, you know, Democrat or whatever in this particular situation. I think, you know, part of the problem, too, there was just like an enthusiasm gap for Hillary Clinton, of course. I mean, the numbers, the voting wasn't all that huge.
Yeah, she wasn't a great candidate by any means. But I just remember listening to it and thinking, OK, let's go back to basic persuasion, you know, foundations. You are offering me nothing. You're telling me that these, you know, a lot of underserved groups have been oppressed for a long time. And yes, I totally get that. But as a white man, like as a white male, I came through academics first. And when I graduated, you know, with my PhD in the mid 90s, all the jobs that I typically could have gotten into, because I wasn't like a high powered academic, were they took those sort of lower level jobs and they used those for affirmative action jobs. You know, they didn't bring them into like the best jobs, they brought them into the jobs where I could have gotten, and I became much less competitive. And then moved over to Hollywood, and the first job I got at Best Damn Sports Show, they brought me in for a 2-day test, which were illegal with the guild. And the head writer told me, he goes, yeah, your stuff's great. I can't hire you because it has to be a minority hire because we're all white guys here. And they never did hire me. They kept me there. I worked for a year and a half and I was never officially hired.
Right. That was your two-day trial extended to a year and a half.
Yeah, because they didn't want to put me on the books as another white male.
It's so minor, this kind of stuff, but in the entertainment industry, it's one of the few places where you can be discriminate just like as much as you want to, because you can put an ad out there. It's just like, I want an ugly Asian guy for this role. And you just have to go, okay, that's what they're looking for. It's specifically what they need for the script or whatever. It's not like you can just adapt that.
Yeah,
it's
you're be not fat Asian enough.
Right, exactly. They'll yell at you about that. I remember a friend of mine was trying to get me into the improv when I was, before I even moved out here, just get into the system, work at some of their clubs. And he, you know, told them about me, whatever. And they asked him, like, what's he look like? And he goes, I don't know, he's got dark hair, white guy, you know, whatever. And they're like, we got enough brunette white guys. And that was it. Didn't matter what your act was, didn't matter what you were bringing to the table, like comedy wise, which you'd think a comedy club might have some interest in. They were just tired of looking at like white guys with dark hair.
Well, and it's tough, man. It's like, you know, the quantitative stuff is powerful. It's a quantitative measures of whether you're a good company or a good person and things like this. Like I told you before we came on, I'm looking at my podcast list and I'm basically just going to my friends to get started, you know, get some experience doing this. And that means like 16 of my interviews have been middle-aged white guys, three women and one Iranian American. And it's like, I'm just going to the people I know. I'm not being discriminatory, and I'll open it up as I go. You know, I'm just trying to get people who will say yes to me. So maybe right. It's that I know how to get middle-aged white guys to say yes.
Well, you would be one of the best middle-aged white hookers we'd ever have.
It's my people.
Yeah, I mean, it is one of those things. You'll find, though, I mean, you start putting feelers out, you'll get other people who want to be a guest on the show because you've got like an interesting stance and things like that. I was able to get a lot of people to come on pretty quickly just by asking because people want to get their message out.
Sure. And you talked to quite a few politicians, right? Or a few politicians?
Yeah, I did. I actually talked to like five different people that were running for president back during the, 2012 cycle? Yeah, I guess so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, talked to Jill Stein. Dr. Jill Stein, sorry.
Doctor, come on. Dr. Jill, yep, Dr. Jill's don't get any respect.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Gary Johnson. Those would be like
sense.
The,
I kind of liked him.
He was all right. You know what? On the phone, I did not care for him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like personally, I started talking to him, and I'm someone who likes almost everybody.
Yeah, you're a Will Rogers. Yeah.
I really do enjoy most people just in general and think that we're going to get along until we don't. And we were talking, and he was just like a little, he was one of the few people that like sort of put my hackles up. Really? So I'm just like, okay, note that, but he, you know, talked the talk, did his little thing.
Were they being platformy? Were they being rote, or were you able to break them out and make them talk?
He was a little more platformy. And at the time, I can't remember what the exact thing was, but something had come up with him and I sort of questioned him on it. And he was very, you know, of course, dodge the issue and go to like the talking points. Dr. Jill, I thought was great. I actually ended up voting for her in that election. Enjoyed talking to her. She seemed like she was a real human. She was smart. She could pivot. She didn't have to stay on talking points. And she was willing to laugh and sort of, you know, enjoy the experience mm-hmm. of talking to someone she hadn't spoken to before. I actually talked to her a couple of times, I think, during the course of the thing, the campaigns. But yeah, I talked to them, talked to a number of different people on the left and right. I talked to Judson Phillips, who was one of the founders of the Tea Party movement. Had him on a couple of times and had some of the most ridiculous arguments with him. Like the first time I had him on, I was like, look, you guys want 60% of the same stuff that Occupy Wall Street wants. Mm-hmm. You know, you agree very much on these things. Like you'd like politicians to be kept in line this way, that way. These are a lot of things, you know, 40% of the stuff we disagree on, maybe wildly, but 60% of it's the same. Why don't you team up with us? We'll get 60% of this stuff done. And then we go our separate ways. And he was like, nope, 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 nope. Like, I don't see your problem. I don't see why you won't. You want to get stuff done, but you don't seem to want to get stuff done.
Yeah, there's all sorts of conflicting issues in these groups, conflicting issues in the psychological profile of many people in politics.
Well, like, you can't admit the other side has reasonable humans. That's the first, they're always the enemy. And that's the, I think, a bad thing that we've done with America. We've now turned Democrats and Republicans into enemies. And we're all Americans. That's the thing that we keep forgetting.
Yeah, you know, I've heard that piece of rhetoric. I heard some people, a lot of people have pulled that up. Most of my reasonable friends are pulling that up now. They'll say to me things like, well, you know, I know conservatives and I know liberals, and really most of them aren't flaming extremists. Like we all kind of want the same thing. So we're all Americans. And that seems to be like a grounding rhetoric that a lot of people are using. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I believe it. I'm not sure that's not the way I really look at it.
Do you think some of us are Russians?
No, I don't really use the same categories. This is one of the cool things I think about rhetoric, being rhetorical and creative. You know, mm-hmm. like creatives, like comics will just find new things, new ways of talking about these people. And that's what's fun about it. It's like, oh, I've never thought about that before.
So rather than like the reds and blues, we maybe call them the smarts and dumbs, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's an option. Like if we wanted to take it on, you know, as a comedic writing project, well, we're going to rename the parties. Mm-hmm. Then we could take it on and we could start being, okay, well, where's the comedy in here? You know, like I used to call it, like I said, is it the reasonables and the unreasonables? Because what you just said was the reasonable thing to do, the rational, reasonable thing to do would be to say, yeah, well, let's get all these things together and double up our energy and our resources. And then we'll worry about the others. but you're a reasonable guy and you're talking to an unreasonable person.
Right. Yeah. That could be a way to break down the parties as well. Yeah. I wish we would just add to the parties. Actually, I wish
like
that
add
there
what?
Were
like more parties, like yeah. There are systems that do that. Like, you know, that have
Canada.
Multiple-
Canada's got like a good probably dozen parties almost that have some degree of power. And I think that would be nice because you could get that more nuanced thing. You know, there are some liberal folks who would support all liberals, except they do have a problem with abortion. Or you've got some folks on the right who would support certain policies, except they've got a problem with this or that or whatever. If you found like a couple of wedge parties, you could probably pick up enough people to get some power, help advance a couple of different points, this and that. But we're too locked into the two-party thing right now. The system itself has created so many barriers to a third party breaking through. You have to get a certain percentage on the national stage before you get onto the larger national stage of the debates. You have to have, you know, certain monetary requirements. You have to be on the ballots in all these different states. All these things that are nearly impossible for a third party to get together compared to the two power structures behind the reasonables and unreasonables. So,
yeah, but they, you know, even within those, like the caucuses, you know, the Freedom Caucus was within the Republican Party. They all vote together. And that's essentially why governmentally that the Republicans are so right and so fundamentalist, because that's a fundamentalist subgroup within the party and they all vote together. And right. They can't get around the Freedom Caucus. They can't get anything else in there because the Freedom Caucus kills it.
Well, and now they've got the problem of having to figure out how to keep the QAnon and the hardcore Trumpers in line and with them without upsetting them by telling them the truth of what actually happened in the election. I've still got friends from North Dakota who are arguing there's no way that Biden could have gotten that many votes because everybody that they're close to liked Trump. So as far as they're concerned, everybody liked Trump. So Biden winning by 7 million is an impossibility. Instead of looking at it like, well, you know, Clinton actually won the popular vote by 3 million. Trump has managed to kill almost 500,000. So that would lose that many for him, you know, but yeah, it's natural after 4 years of a bad performance that more people turned out enthusiastically to vote against him. And then some still supported like the Republicans down ticket.
Yeah. But
which is how so many stayed in.
So I'm in the middle. I just filed I do these little lesson modules for the master course in persuasion, and they take a while to actually, what I find is trying to boil down sort of complicated rhetorical principles into something that's still smart, but now accessible. You know, it's an enjoyable read and that it has some simplicity to it so that people can use it right away.
Pictures, lots of pictures.
I need video and images are next. Right now it's just all right. Text because I do work. I'm a writer. You know,
yeah.
You don't have a production team. So you get writing is what you get right now, by God.
Start thinking like you're having to present these ideas to Trump and you'll hit a larger audience.
Yeah, I don't care about the larger audience. I care about it being clear and simple, but it's not going to be, it's not going to be stupid. So yeah. The one thing I was writing today about claims, and then the next module is about evidence, because there's, you know, training. I wrote a line last week about everybody seems in America seems to love to argue. Nobody seems to want to learn how to argue. Nobody's got any training in it, you know? Right. And so just like there's a thing called the Toulmin model of argument, which has six parts. And when you look at it and you go, oh, these are the six parts of an argument and each one of them can be done well or badly. Evidence is going to be next week. And it's such a big area. If you ever looked at the way courts do evidence, The rules of evidence in a courtroom are insane. They're pages and pages and pages of what you can do and can't do, because evidence goes crazy instantly. Information goes awry instantly. And to control it so that you can keep it somewhat reliable is really hard. So like you see people like you're talking about who look around themselves as this is my everyday experience. That's the strongest evidence I've got. I'll pull a conclusion from it. And you're right. Like, that is the worst evidence down into warrant, down to conclusion I've ever seen. You can't do that.
Right. But it's my experience. So from the empirical knowledge standpoint, this is existence. this is what the world is. It doesn't matter that you've got like outside sources trying to tell you what life in Los Angeles is like when you're living in Cavalier, North Dakota with 1,000 other people who think basically like you do. There are the few outliers who are still up there and trying to like convince people what reality is. And it's, I hats off to them.
Well, so few people in America actually do discussion. They don't do, you know, they blare out their opinions and they get a ton of media, you know, input, and that lives on in their heads, but they don't really dialogue like this, where they sit down for an hour and talk about an issue and learn, like, you know, I kind of remembered now that you did the Occupy thing, but I didn't realize you were that deeply into it, you know, and the fact that you've had internal experience with that and you had specific issues and that you did the radio show, you know, takes you up a level to the point where you're it's worthy to learn from you. You know, you've had direct experience that other people haven't.
Sorry for laughing.
Most people, it's not worthy to learn from them. They don't have any. So I had a buddy who's gone over to Fox and sweetheart guy, and it always bothers me. And last time I saw him, he just brought up, well, you know, what about immigration? And I'm like, well, what about it? You're a white guy sitting in a $600,000 house in Fort Worth. What are you scared of? They're going to, you know, more immigrants are going to come and build your next swimming pool. What? And he's like, well, it just bothers me. And I'm like, well, I'll tell you what, let's get in the car. We're about 4 hours from the border. Let's go down and see what's going on. You have zero experience of the border. You've never been over the border other than a plane going to Acapulco.
Did he take you up on it? Did you guys?
No, he didn't take me up on it.
Of course not. Yeah, confront reality. What?
Real experience, real evidence is a bitch, man. It takes a lot of work.
I have that issue talking to people back home. I've crossed the border a lot. I go down to Mexico occasionally, or was going down to Mexico to pick up some meds. I've got asthma, and the medication down there, you can get like a 5-month
cover
supply,
story, dude. Good cover.
Yeah, right. So anyway, my Adderall, asthma. So I can get like 5 months supply for what it cost me for like a month in the US. So I cross the border frequently and I see what Tijuana's like. I mean, I go down to a strip mall. It's like shopping at a CVS in the United States. I go down to a place there. I've got a membership card where I get like bonus points that build up after I buy so much stuff. It's the same, except people are more darkly skinned than I am, and they speak a different language that I have to really work to make my way through. But they're fine. They're wonderful. They're awesome. I've had no trouble going down there anytime. I've gotten lost a few times, ended up at like weird little pharmacias somewhere else that weren't part of a nice, you know, homogenized strip mall, and still got somebody who would help me and work with me and patiently listen to me butcher Spanish. And, you know, eventually sold me what I needed.
So that's your empirical evidence of that Tijuana is safer than everybody's been told.
Tijuana, you know, these donkey shows, they've got people at the door. No, that's just like that basic thing. And then the other trips that my wife and I have made down there, we've been to a couple of different places.
What's your wife's
name
again?
Gray.
Gray Drake. Duck. What was it? Gray what?
Gray Drake.
Drake. Duck.
Yeah, which is actually a type of swan, not duck. So
a drake is a swan?
Yeah, it's a male swan.
Really?
Yep.
There's a drake duck.
You know, there may also be the drake. It may be the male duck. There's drakes and hens, I think, are how they break it down.
Okay.
But I always think of it as the swan just because of whatever.
Yeah, it's nicer. It's a big white duck.
You know, yeah, if I'm going to compare my wife to anything, I'm going swan and not
go
like
swan male. Every time. There's no Duck Lake ballet, tell you that.
It's great how you've got that green ring around your neck, honey. So I forget where I was going with that. Oh no, so we've been down to like Monterey, we've been to you know, a couple of the resort towns and stuff like that, and they've all been fun areas you want to stay out of. And it's also very off-putting to be walking down a street and see guards with machine guns in front of banks. That's just a typical thing in a lot of the communities down there. And it's something you're not used to here. We're used to, like, you know, Barney Fife with a bullet in his pocket, you know, in case things go bad there at
the bank.
It's
coming though. That's the whole capital resurrection, right? It's like, man, we got a lot of guns in this country. You just never see them. Now we may have to start seeing them.
Yeah. It's going to be an interesting time here for the next, I don't know how many years. We've gone through like a good 40-year period from Reagan on, I think, to set us up where we are today. And from here on out, the recovery, if we can actually manage it, hey, you know how easy it is to screw things up. It usually takes twice as long to fix them.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Like you, when you really dig into this stuff from a, at least from a messaging perspective and a strategy perspective, it was Nixon. You know, Nixon came out of the McCarthy era. He was on the McCarthy panels, you know. He used those same techniques of the commies are coming to get us. You know, he was one of the senators, you know, with the blacklist. Right. And he, you know, adapted all this stuff and decided, well, they screwed up the, you know, the Democrats screwed up their attachment to the South with the Civil Rights Act. Let's go in there and get the Southerners. And he did it, man. And the party's still riding that ugly surfboard.
Yeah. Yeah, most definitely. A little trivia side note, by the way, one of the prosecutors in the Watergate hearings, a guy named Rufus Edmiston, who was a politician back in North Carolina.
He prosecuted the
Watergate? He was one of them. Yeah, he was one of the guys that was on the prosecution side and became Secretary of State in North Carolina. And I went to an event for him one night doing comedy, and he made me an official honorary Secretary of State.
Really?
Yeah, he had cards printed off. He would just write your name in and like give it to you, and you were like honorary Secretary of State for life.
Do you want to hear my Rufus Edmiston story?
Oh, yes, I do.
It's just the opposite of yours.
Uh-oh. He took away your citizenship?
Well, pretty much. I was doing a gig, a benefit at one of the golf clubs there in North Carolina, and he was in the audience.
Tommy set you up with that by any chance?
I don't remember, maybe. Maybe.
Okay.
Yeah. And I was doing a bit about being from Kentucky, and he yelled out drunkenly, Yankee, Yankee. And I'm like, dude, you cannot call me a Yankee from Kentucky. He goes, yeah, you were neutral in the Civil War. Didn't fight on our side. So he excommunicated me from the South.
Yep. Very opposite opinions then with Rufus.
Yeah,
hilarious. I knew. He was actually a very funny guy. And I mean, you know, for a politician, I think got some stuff done. Also got in some trouble at some point. There were a couple of different like dust ups where Rufus had, I think, used funds like inappropriately to redecorate his office or something.
His name is Rufus. Come on. what are you going to get when you bring in a guy named Rufus?
Yep. But yeah, that's, you know. It's a weird world, because I remember going home like when I was a kid, when the Watergate hearings were going on, and I actually paid a little attention to them. Not just in that they were screwing up my afternoon TV watching and all the cartoons and Batman reruns weren't available. I watched a little bit, and it's weird to watch adults get in trouble, I guess, when you're like at that
age.
That's
and you're true.
Sort of seeing the whole thing go down. It's like, wow, this is some serious whatever. And then years later to meet somebody who was involved in that process. It's just like one of those, wow, it's a small world. And if you're paying attention to a lot of different factions of it, you realize how the interconnectivity and everything works.
Well, we've been on that side, on that from the other side in comedy. People meet you, you know, in real life. Like I've been out places and somebody's like, oh my God, you're the comedian from such and such. And, you know, you're a mythical figure. And politics is the same way. It's a different mythology.
And, it's show business for ugly people, as it was referred to.
Yeah, it's show business without, you know, yeah, without as much, doesn't look as much fun, but maybe it is. I don't know. But I look at it and, you know, from my perspective of, I'm kind of interested now. I never did politics. It wasn't until Trump I got interested when I started to see, oh, okay, here's a really strong unethical rhetoric coming in and it's creating storm. Like it's the first time there was the ability to get in there and create a storm.
That's interesting to me that you weren't, you're a smart guy. And I would have assumed that you were more of a political animal just because of that.
I you know, monitor politics, but my area was, you know, with intellectualism, like that takes up most of your time. So in academics, you know, I was studying persuasion. And then I moved over to media studies and things like that. So I had plenty to think about over there. I didn't need to think about politics. And most of my rhetorical background was in storytelling and entertainment. And so one of the reasons I got interested with Trump is Trump brought entertainment principles over into politics. And so he was the first person, you know, Reagan did a little bit because Reagan was a dramatic actor. And so if you look back at Reagan's speeches and things like that, you know, it's there's high drama in his speeches. The fact that he had the Russia as the, you know, big evil empire and all that to fight against was important in the Reagan mythology. But Trump just brought reality show politics over and literally has just done. I think sometimes Trump looks out and goes, why are people upset with me? You know, this gets good ratings. Yeah.
He was for so many years protected by the production company around him over at The Apprentice. They took away the stuff that would have gotten him in trouble with the public. They kept the tape secret where he says horrible things.
Yeah,
They covered all that for him. And he's upset that he hasn't had that around him while doing politics. Excuse me. He assumed that his whole team would be doing the same thing. You do damage control. You make sure the stuff that I do that's good looks great.
Yeah.
You know, you, and then at the end of it, I say somebody's fired and we're good.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that is the entertainment world. And that's the, when I talk about the big changes right now in politics, we've never had a political environment like this ever. Everybody wants to talk about, oh, we've had this stuff before. No, you haven't. You've never had a social media. You've never had the high production value cable media. You know, production is so fast now and so widespread. Back, you know, in the concrete days, there were three networks who filtered everything. Nobody got on national TV. You'd never see a senator or a congressman talking to the nation. It never happened.
Yeah, there weren't allowed hour-long periods where somebody could just spill disinformation without any kind of blowback.
There was no access for them to talk nationally. None. You know, just the leadership would get, you know, a clip here and there. And so now suddenly we're exposed to this massive, you know, hurricane of political discourse, you know, because the channels have expanded so much and we don't know what to do with it. Like Americans, human beings are not used to processing this much information coming that highly produced. It's not even close. And you've seen it overwhelming everybody's brains.
I used to know one of the guys who was one of the first newsmen on CNN. When CNN first started up as like a 24-hour news, you know, station and network.
What was
and
his
he
name?
Said at the time, John something. I cannot recall his last name right now.
I know
now.
A guy. We have all these overlaps today. I know a guy who started CNN too, Jim Guthrie.
Oh, interesting. I can't think of John's last name. And I went for like a lunch with his wife and he one time when I was back during my first marriage and stuff. My wife had met him through like a real estate deal. She was doing some real estate at the time, my ex-wife. And nice guy, great guy. And we talked about just discussing CNN and stuff like that at different points. He said, we were worried that we wouldn't have enough to like fill the cycle. And we had these hour-long shows constantly where you went really in-depth and got really wonky with these people. And so it was really fascinating and it was really great for us. We felt like we were really doing something by giving a little more life to these stories and more in-depth. And at that point, when I knew him, this would have been like early 2000s, he was like, now it's turned into just these 15-second sound bites, you know, that are repeated throughout the day. And it's the same story at the top of the hour, every hour until a new, bigger, scarier, whatever story, you know, more impressive, more entertaining would take over the cycle. And he said, so it's turned into like this monster that we didn't imagine. We were just worried about like, how do you fill 24 hours? And now it's like, well, we're filling 24 hours with like 15 minutes of news.
Right.
And people are getting terrified because they're hearing this thing repeated over and over again about whatever it might be. So it's,
yeah, and that's the nature of, you know, entertainment. That's what hasn't happened is people haven't adjusted to, like, everybody, you know, Trump comes in and bitches about the media and fake media, and everybody has accepted this now that the media is biased and all this. And I'm like,
right,
no, the media is aesthetic. It has an aesthetic that everybody will pay attention to, like terror, danger, fear, intensity of emotion, you know, quick stories, all these things. Those are aesthetics.
Right.
But if you don't treat them like that, if you treat them like information, then you're filtering your information in from the wrong channel, you know, and suddenly you're addicted to this stuff.
Right. You've got fear-based information coming in, which causes stuff to fire off in your brain. And so you get addicted to that feeling of like, I'm a little scared, but I think I'm doing okay. You know,
well, they do dissonance and catharsis constantly. They ramp it all up, and then they cut to a commercial, or they cut to a different story, or bring somebody else in, and things like that. So they heighten it and let you down a little bit.
Right.
And heighten, let you down a little bit. And so that aesthetic experience is what gets everybody. But then that's, like you said, that's how we're getting our information. It warps the information.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. It is a weird time to be trying to just like discuss points with people, because you can't always agree on what reality is. Like I was saying earlier, there are people who just will not at this point believe that Biden got 7 million more votes than Trump. You can do whatever you want. You can show them how the process works. You can explain whatever up and down. You know, there's members from Republicans and Democrats who watch the counts. There are a number of people here and there. Stuff doesn't just come out from underneath tables and, you know, fill up the numbers. They had predicted months before the election that this red wave thing would happen where, yeah, all the people voting in person are probably going to be Trump supporters, and then the mail-in votes will be counted, and those are all going to be Democrats. We knew this was coming. And then when it happened, a certain percentage of the country shocked and amazed this could have happened. And it's like, no, people who understand this have been predicting it for months. The people who want you to feel a certain way when the results come out have been telling you something different.
Well, there's your reasonableness again. How dare you?
Yeah, right. I do have that thing where I don't just go like, you know, all conservatives are assholes, even though a lot of them are. I go, a lot of them have been misled, and they've been misled by a multi-billion dollar effort over a number of decades.
Yeah,
since
it's pretty,
the fairness doctrine went away and Fox News was able to just say whatever they want, and Rush Limbaugh was able to just blather whatever he wanted into the airwaves, and there's no consequence and there's no kickback or anything like that. Then yeah, you're going to end up with like an entire group of people who are underinformed, and the stuff they do have information about is completely wrong. So how do we counteract that, Dan French, doctor?
That's exactly right. How do we do that? And that's what the Converting Conservatives course will teach you.
Ooh,
actually,
I should sign up for that.
I'll give you a free pass. You can come in as much as you want.
Sweet.
But I use the nice thing about actually having an academic background in something that applies to an area is that it's, you know, rich with ideas and techniques for dealing with things. So I teach people conversion. Like, you can't do persuasion on people whose brains have been overtaken by media mesmerization. You know, once you've been mesmerized and hyperactivated emotionally, drenched in misinformation and all that kind of stuff, you're not accessible to reasonable talk-oriented persuasion anymore. It just doesn't work, and you should never do it, because all you're going to do is trigger all the alarms and bells inside of them, and you're going to make it worse for them. They're not going to enjoy talking to you, and it's going to be counterproductive. So you have to go through different channels. And in conversion, one of the ways of doing this is it's really just following along a lot of the stuff that you get in psychotherapy, which is my structure for it is the first stage of discovery. You have to let them talk, and talk in a way without judgment, talk away with acceptance and things like that. They have to get their information out, whether it's shitty or not. And it's so hard for a reasonable, you know, person to listen to that stuff.
Like, right. You want to go along the way. You want to go, no, that's wrong. No. Wait, that's wrong. Yeah.
You feel it inside your body, because you know, they're like, oh, this isn't reality. They're stuck on something, but you have to do discovery. So you have to let them do that. And then you have to create a relationship with them, like an intimate relationship where they'll trust you so that they can actually process with you.
Bond with them somehow so that they'll actually listen to you as like an authority or a source of good information.
Well, it's literally creating a real relationship. And this is what I do in the second part of that course. Like, you have all these interpersonal skills that we all learn, but you have to amplify them and make them purposeful. So like, for example, acceptance. Like, you do not talk to people who argue with everything you say. If they dislike everything you are saying, you will avoid them, right?
Right.
Because you don't like negativity coming back at you. You like positivity. That's how you choose your friends. That's how you choose your relationships. So if you are not doing that with them, if you're not being positive and accepting, then they're not going to create a relationship, and you are not going to convert them. So you have to find ways of saying, hey, you know, I understand, like, yeah, Trump did get a ton of votes. He got 74 million votes. That's more votes than any presidential candidate everywhere. That's pretty amazing. Why do you think that is? Like, why do you think people voted for him? Like, finding ways of encouraging them to talk as opposed to stomping on their bullshit. You have to train yourself to be able to do that. And then if you can go through those two stages, then they can open themselves up a little bit, persuasion again, you know, and it's a slow process. But if you don't do that, you're never going to get through.
I find that discussing things like this with people who are, you know, very muchly against hearing anything, humor, of course, helps. Like, if you can make a little joke about something where you just sort of poke a little hole at something, not like punch it. You don't just like take it down, like, hard. Boom, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. But you go, yeah, isn't it strange that such and such? And you, if you're able to just sort of slide it in, they'll still at least keep listening to you. They might not agree with it, but I think that stuff starts to wear a little bit at them. I don't know.
And they wear themselves out. The problem with that stuff is they are, you know, parroting things that they've heard. They're parroting script. These aren't things that they've thought their way to. Like, my friend knows nothing about immigration. You know, zero, literally nothing. Never met an immigrant. I asked him, you know.
But he's scared by it.
But he's scared by it, and he it bothers him. And so they're parroting script that's been handed down from a think tank that they'll never see, you know, ever. They don't know anything about. And so they'll wear themselves out because they don't have that much misinformation. And once they say it a little bit, then they exhaust the gas tank. They won't really repeat themselves because they'll start to see, their brain will start to go, oh, maybe that isn't logical. And you don't have to point it out. And comedy's good because they don't protect themselves as much from comedy, as long as it's not, you say, it's not, you know, a zinger. It's like a very light little, you know, nibble on something. So comedy's great for that stuff. But so the program really is convert one conservative. This is my big nonprofit for the next 2 years before the midterms. Is convert one conservative. This shit is way too much work to do with more than one person.
Wait, is this okay? So the goal of everybody who's watching this series of classes, lessons, the goal is for all of them collectively to convert one. We're just hoping to get one conservative on the other side, or each person has
each
to get
person,
one.
Yeah,
okay,
that'd be a lot of pressure.
that guy would be so informed.
Like, there's 80 million people have voted for Biden. If 20% of them converted one conservative, then 100 million people you have on your side to vote next time. So, like, it is way too much work. Everybody wants to do monologue persuasion or social media persuasion. You're never going to break through, you know, that kind of psyche, what's happened to, you know, the right wing psyche. But pick one person, your uncle, your mom, whoever, you know, like my son, my 18-year-old, because he's an 18-year-old male and has, you know, done well in school and, you know, is healthy and, you know, attractive kid. And he's a good kid. He has empathy challenges.
Sure.
You know,
I my best friend actually has something like this. His younger son, who is in his 20s now, is very successful because he's a hard worker. He will bust his hump all day and all night. He has come through sort of a hard life. His mom had some challenges. He's made it. He's made it work. And so when you come to him with, like, you know, immigrants or these different races have it very difficult in this country, he can't hear that because he's had difficulty in overcome it.
Yeah.
He doesn't look to the fact that, look, just as a white guy having difficulty, you've got such an edge up over a black guy having difficulty. That comparison doesn't exist.
Right. And that makes total sense. And I think if there's one place that liberal Democrats need to really focus, it is the young white men. They're the one that caused the problems. They're ones that voted for Trump. They're empathy challenged as a species, you know, because they're stronger. That you can live as a white male as an individual in this culture and do just fine. You know, you're very rarely in danger. You're not scared of physical, you know, being physically attacked. You have all these advantages, you know, they're not even really advantages, what everybody should have. You know,
you just don't have the disadvantages piled on top of it.
Right.
Yeah.
But they lose empathy because they know that their life isn't perfect. It's not easy. Right. They did have to work. All that is completely true.
And in some cases, they've overcome a lot. They've really, it's not even like, it's not an easy life. It's like, it's been a hard life and they've overcome that.
And so the whole rhetoric of helping others is the wrong rhetoric to use for them. It really should be, how can we help you? You know, because that's what they're used to and that's what they would respond to. And then you can get in there, then you have a relationship, then you start to expand what they see and you can do some conversion. But if you don't go through those stages, you're just always going to be, what's wrong with young white guys? You know, they're just shooting everything up and they don't give a shit. And I'm like, well, there's a reason for that. They're not biologically born that way. They're culturally created, which means you can change it, you know? So yeah, that's the idea.
Yeah. No, it is a fine effort and I wish you all the luck in the world with it because man knows we need something because, we're in a messed up place where people don't understand the system of politics that they're now suddenly engaged in, which is why the QAnon folks and the Trump supporters actually thought that January 6th, something could be done.
Right.
Like, you know, if Biden just says the magic words, boom, we have to have a whole other election or something. It's like, no, this has all been certified by the states, which was certified on the county levels, which was certified in the cities, this is all up and down the line has already been taken care of. There is nothing to be done on January 6th, but people still believed that there was that thing because we don't understand the arcane system of, you know, electoral colleges and how our voting system works.
Yeah, well, we shouldn't understand it. Like you said, it's arcane. It's come from the past. It's, you know, got all these weird, you know, sub rules within it that have been developed over time, you know, by people that we don't know. And it is confusing. You know, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense the way people vote. It doesn't make sense why they vote for who they do. Nobody really understands each other. So when you get into that and you're like, okay, well, we need to clean some things up here. The only real answer, you can't really limit the unethical persuaders. Predators are going to predate, and that's what they do.
Yes.
All you can do is make the prey a lot better at understanding what's coming their way, you know? And so to do some education and, you know, get people to see that, you know, that's really what the goal should be, where our energy should be, but we'll see.
Yeah. So getting back to what you were asking before, after North Dakota, then I moved to North Carolina. No, it's
and the fourth hour of the podcast goes. Here we go. Well, it's been super fun, man. Like I keep catching up with people I haven't talked to for like, you know, 10, 15 years.
Yeah, I saw you had Kostaki on the other day. That's always a blast. I had a lunch with him not too long ago.
Yeah, he's awesome. I mean, I've collected all these nice people from all these different worlds that I've worked in and been in, you know, over the years. So it's been super fun actually talking directly for an hour about things. So I've enjoyed it. Whether somebody will listen to it or not, who cares?
Hey, look, don't let that stop you. Have you seen how many podcasts people are pumping out there?
As
soon as this pandemic hit, like the podcast category on iTunes quadrupled.
Yeah.
And it's all, you know, the same, you know, if you're lucky, you get like 20 people, a lot of these guys, but.
And it'd be interesting. I taught this stuff in universities for 20 years. I know what it's like to teach 18 to 20 year olds who don't care about it. very curious about getting it out to adults again. And I've done some of this through comedy. We'll see how it goes, you know, for a brand online and doing podcasts and blogs and things like that. I'm enjoying it. So.
Oh, that's the important thing, you know.
That's all.
You got to enjoy some of this life, aside from trying to educate people and make changes and stuff like that. Enjoy a little of this.
As I'm enjoying it. I don't need to pay rent. That's fine. I enjoy being, you know, on the streets. I'm all good.
Right.
But look
for you on a corner of Austin, just yelling rhetoric at people.
Rhetoric. Well, that's the cynics, Diogenes. That's what they used to do: is bark shit at people. That's why they were known as the cynics. They yelled out honest evaluations of people on the street.
That's how you find an honest man. You just give him honesty and wait till he gives it back to you, I guess.
Of course, they were killed a lot by people who didn't like what they said. But hey, that's the price you pay for being a rhetorician. So, appreciate it. Thanks very much. I will talk to you soon or not, another 10 years.
we'll do another podcast in a while. If anybody wants to find me on the internet, I am at Steve Gelder, G-E-L-D-E-R on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, pretty much any place you'd want to follow me. I just call myself by my name. It's worked so far.
Yeah, it's a good name. The Geld. I always, for some reason, I always think of Geldenstern and Rosencrantz are dead.
Oh, nice. I, being from a farming community, used to get gelding a lot as an insult.
Well, you're the gelder. You're not the gelding.
Yeah, that's, yeah, keep that in mind, buddy.
Yeah, don't get too close. Well, thanks again for coming. We'll see you again next time on Rhetoric Warriors. And remember, you know, thinking is great, but maybe good thinking is even better. So we'll talk to you soon.